as well as an hour with Noam Chomsky as part of our year-end conversations. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. You can access Democracy Now! At democracynow.org and check out Democracy Now! On Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube, and beyond. Tell your friends about independent, international, investigative news hour that is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prototype people, rigid suit trolls near brain dead, under for spacious skies gathering storm clouds, rule of law, a falling axe in stormtroopers' hands, cruel class deceivers claim God for their sign, making up stories with places for meanings to hide. Dracula drinks deeply while nourishing his trap, the love of mankind in alluring narcotic rap.
Fable.
Sex Fable does love, sex is life, and sex meant death. Homosexual needles as if laboratories don't exist. Bacterial warfare, AIDS, testament to death man's kiss. Drug master using drugs to blame poverty and crime. Money master cashes in on the people's golden light. Skulls and crossbones uniformly waiting in time. Raging peace, stone Satan spoiling for the fight. In wars for souls, prophets are in casualties. Spilling scenes from fables and other realities. Tinted eyes. Concepts of love possess concepts of love. Growing up fears traveling faster than light. Love is as blind as the people who see. Emotional playgrounds intense as battleground. User words for protection leave a hollow sound. The prince and the maiden don't stand a chance. A fiddler plays, but they're too confused to dance. Their love was smooth, then the love was rough. The lessons of living didn't teach them enough. There's the man, the woman, and all those dualities, the material of fables and other realities.
While the mute proclaim the glory. And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. This is an hour live program during the time of COVID, the resurgent COVID. Oh my goodness. Omicron has beset us. And 2 years and running. Yeah, folks. It's been a crazy ride. But we've been here all through it. KBOO going strong. We are on our end of the year membership drive. Runs on Tammy, who's running the board this morning, and me live on the microphone, and you, who may not yet be a member of this listener-sponsored member-run station, and you can do that. You can do that oh so easily by going to kboo.fm, click on the donate button. This is it's end of the year drive, so we have till the end of the year, and so we're trying to get to our 45,000 goal as quickly as we can. We do have another matching grant. We have a one-to-one match up to $8,000 courtesy of a group of donors who wish to remain anonymous. So that means that if you contribute $50, that means you're contributing $100. If you contribute $100, that means $200. Do I need to go on? I don't think so. I think you get the point. So yes, KBOO.fm. We mentioned sometimes because of COVID, we don't have our regular lively crew here pitching with a bunch of our different hosts and volunteers. And, it's not the same thing, but we're still going. We're still here. We're still live. We're still 24/7. We've been going 52 years and strong, and we want to keep going quite a bit more. Looks like somebody's calling in already. I don't know if they're calling in to donate, but we would appreciate if you go to kbo.fm. You can also text KBOO to 44321. That's another way to do it. You can also mail it in the old-fashioned way to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Yeah, become a member today if you haven't already. If you feel so inspired, up your membership. If you are able, give now and double the impact of your contribution. So, Fables and Other Realities, that's what I started the show out with. That was John Trudell. That was from his album of the same name, Fables and Other Realities. Came out 30 years ago, can you believe it? 1991. And John left us for the spirit world just 2 weeks ago on December 8th, 6 years ago in 2015. A powerful voice, appeared quite often on this radio station. I interviewed him several times. Other people did. His music has been played here. One of the few places you'll ever hear the music of John Trudell. So I want to talk about Fables and Other Realities this morning. I'm flying solo this morning, so you will be my companions to have a conversation here on the air. We're coming on Christmas, as you know, and there's obviously this idea, this crazy idea of the war on Christmas. We can talk about that if you want. I've talked about that a number of times on this program. the fake war on Christmas, actually the real war on Christmas, all went all the way back to the Puritans, who saw it as kind of a corruption. And in some ways, they were right, but not in the way they intended. The crass capitalist commercialism of Christmas, that's not what their right wing is talking about. They want to keep that going, but they think that there's a war on the holiday of Christmas itself. And, you know, there's a basis in that, in that, yeah, why not talk about other religions, other religious celebrations than Christmas? Why is that the dominant one? Is this really a Christian nation? Do you believe that? Well, I'd like to hear from you. 503-231-8187. We can have a, you know, I'm thinking about that. We can have a heated conversation if you want. But I've been thinking about this idea that, you know, the culture wars really hit home when people gather around for holidays, especially Thanksgiving and Christmas. And, you know, there's this idea of not talking about politics, not talking about religion, to keep things civil, to keep things peaceful. It's kind of this major trope of our times. But, you know, that's never really sat well. You know, why can't we actually have real conversations? I think the problem is people don't, you know, we just don't have a lot of practice in real debate, in real conversation. I mean, yeah, sitting around the table, maybe that's not the best time. Maybe, you know, after you've eaten your meal, filled your fill, you know, maybe had your coffee or tea, you're sitting around. It's kind of nice just to relax. But, you know, what's wrong with having a real conversation? I think people don't want to have real conversations about their, you know, about family, deep family things. About, there's so much that we want to hide in this culture. There's so much that's suppressed and repressed. And whose interest is it to keep these things silent? You know, it goes all the way back to the founding. Who really was kept silent? Who has been kept silent in the history of this country? Whose voices have been marginalized and suppressed and haven't been able to come to the table, as it were, and talk? So yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I've talked a fair amount about Vine Deloria. I mentioned this book, God is Red. I'm not sure, maybe it was last year around this time, who knows? You get to thinking about this stuff. But you know, there's a lot of things I haven't talked about openly myself. You know, some experiences have been very formative to me in my, I don't know, deepest feelings, thoughts about these things. So, you know, maybe it's time for me to share a little bit of that with you. What would I be talking about with, I don't know, my sisters and brothers around the table if we really had a chance to get it out and not sort of walk on eggshells and beat around the bush, as it were? And what are the things that you aren't able to express in those circumstances? Why not have a conversation around that? 503-231-8187. So, yeah, I want to kind of just intersperse some of my thoughts and experiences with this book, God is Red, The Native View of Religion, which has had a major formative experience on me. And I guess I'll just say at the outset that I was open to this because I was, you know, really privileged to be able to actually have direct experience in a Native American ceremonial circumstances, which, you know, one reason I haven't wanted to talk about this is because it's, you know, it's a very sensitive subject. The idea of non-Native people participating in these ceremonies, and, you know, for good reason, because there's been a lot of abuse, there's been a lot of appropriation and co-optation and misuse of Native American ceremonies. And so I've basically kind of kept silent, but it's had a major formative influence on me. Maybe it comes out in the way I talk about things, the way I think about things, the way I interact with the world. So yeah, I mean, I was just basically taken up by some Native Americans who were, who attended ceremonies. I really didn't seek it out. I just kind of happened upon it, which is something that I don't know if it's as easy to happen now as it was back when I was coming of age. I don't know if just the right place, the right time, who knows. But yeah, so I went to a number of Sundances. I actually attended some peyote ceremonies, which is even more controversial because although I think white people are able to ingest the sacred peyote in certain circumstances, it's a, you know, it's a very, very sensitive issue. As I said, I was just a youngster with open eyes and an openness to the world. But yeah, these things really, really turned my head around, basically showed me that there is a real sacredness to the world that I hadn't really experienced before. I mean, growing up, I was kind of I was a little bit mystically inclined. You know, that's the way I look at it. I think I had I was open to a certain natural phenomenon in a way. I sought out certain, places, experiences. But these experiences were, as I said, were very formative. I had a revelatory experience actually at a Sundance where I fasted for 4 days for the first time in my life. And so, like I said, I could go a little more deeper into it, I said that basically to preface why I felt I was open to books like God is Red, A Native View of Religion, and why I became so committed back in the 80s and 90s to supporting Native American rights and causes, fishing rights on the Columbia River. We defended sacred spaces, formed the Sacred Earth Coalition, which is a group of not Indians and non-Indians here in the Portland area, fought against the expansion of Mount Hood Meadows, fought to protect Enola Hill from logging, had some successes and some not so, because it's hard to go up against the colonial machinery, as it were. So yeah, it was around that time that I came across this book, and it really, really hit me, his contrasting the Christian worldview as being a time oriented, a sort of a, what's the word, apocalyptic, I guess, but there's another word for it. Sort of the idea of, well, the idea of that there's end times, well, that, there's certainly the Bible fable narrative of the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve, and then Jesus appearing and sort of having a new creation, as it were, and then the idea that when Jesus returned, there would be this sort of cosmic ending of life as we know it, and sort of this fabled rebirth, which, as I said, I think it's a fable, and I think it's basically, talking about the Christmas story, it's basically given fodder to the colonial enterprise, when the colonial machinery, what it does is it disturbs, disrupts, destroys the existing cultural life ways that were rooted in a place, and causes great trauma, chaos, death, and destruction. And that what Christianity does is it sort of gives this lifeline to adopt this whole other way, which is detached from the place of the people. And it allows them to enter into this mythological world. You know, if you can't beat them, join them, I guess, is a big part of it. So anyway, so I think Vine DeLoria was one of the people who really thought deeply about this, way beyond anything I'm capable of. And so I'm just going to read a little bit. The division of domestic ideologies may appear to be quite artificial to many people. Traditionally, we have been taught to define differences neither by ancestral backgrounds nor cultural attitudes, but by political persuasions. Conservative and liberal, terms that initially describe political philosophies, have taken on the aspect of being able to stand for cultural attitudes of fairly distinct content. Liberals appear to have more sympathy for humanity, while conservatives worship corporate freedom and self-help doctrines underscoring individual responsibility. The basic philosophical differences between liberals and conservatives are not fundamental, however, because both find in the idea of history a thesis by which they can validate their ideas. When the domestic ideology is divided according to American Indian and Western European immigrant, however, and he's leaving aside, obviously, the African people who were enslaved and brought here, and the other Asian and other groups that came later, but he's basically, as from a native standpoint, talking about the very beginning. So anyway, when the domestic ideology is divided according to American Indian and Western European immigrant, however, the fundamental difference is one of great philosophical importance. American Indians hold their lands, places, as having the highest possible meaning, and all their statements are made with this reference point in mind. Immigrants review the movement of their ancestors across the continent as a steady progression of basically good events and experiences, thereby placing history, time, in the best possible light. When one group is concerned with the philosophical problem of space and the other with the philosophical problem of time, then the statements of either group do not make much sense when transferred from one context to the other without the proper consideration of what is taking place. Western European peoples have never learned to consider the nature of the world discerned from a spatial point of view, and a singular difficulty faces peoples of Western European heritage in making a transition from thinking in terms of time to thinking in terms of space. The very essence of Western European identity involves the assumption that time proceeds in a linear fashion. Further, it assumes that at a particular point in the unraveling of this sequence, the peoples of Western Europe became the guardians of the world. The same ideology that sparked the Crusades, the Age of Exploration, the Age of Imperialism, and the recent crusade against communism, which of course is kind of fading, although it comes back with the alt-right. Anyway, that's my insert there. All involve the affirmation that time is peculiarly related to the destiny of the people of Western Europe, and later, of course, the United States. The post-war generation of which we are a part has refused to accept any alteration of this fundamental premise. It is particularly revealing that the first major doctrine enunciated as an anti-communist foreign policy was that of containment. Through containment, it was believed the spread of communism could be restricted to certain geographical areas from which no further extensions of communist ideologies could emanate. Anyway, this is may be a little dated, although not really. Without venturing further into the field of foreign affairs, it may be well to note in passing that the determination of two American presidents fighting in Vietnam not to be the first to lose a war. Anyway, it goes on. It's hard to read books on the air because I can't read the whole thing, and it's kind of hard to jump from place to place. But so yeah, the idea of my immersion into, you know, briefly into Native American place and time really allowed me to see my own culture and history through a different lens, a different perspective, which was, you know, as I said, fundamental to me. I actually came to view, I really did come to view things spatially because I had, you know, I visited the places on the Columbia River where the Native people continued to fish, these kind of embattled spots called the Inloo sites, Cook's Landing, Underwood, Celilo Village, other spots that, you know, were like a different world, different countries almost. It's really interesting to be able to have that experience, and to, you know, one looks at one's own, you know, like some of the, you know, mid 20th century anthropologists like Margaret Mead and others who actually went to other places and immersed themselves in those cultures, and then came to look at their own culture through different eyes. And, you know, that was a very, very important moment, you know, which led to, you know, helped lead to the sort of, really the cultural revolt of the 1960s. All that kind of, those strands fit in. Anyway, so yeah, I came to see the, you know, the city of Portland and this whole constructed environment as a foreign imposition, a colonial world. Just didn't belong here. It just wasn't appropriate to the landscape, the way that, you know, the fishing platforms at Shearer's Falls on the Deschutes, or, you know, along the Columbia River or other places, or, you know, the beautiful longhouse at Celilo Village. So, you know, I always, and then at the same time, with the people in the American Indian movement and the Native American struggle, there's a lot of pushback against, as I was talking about, the expropriation, the abuse of Native ceremonies, and by some of their own people, actually, who are called plastic medicine people. And there's a whole list, and then there's a, you know, calling out the New Agers for abusing their ceremonies. So I was, you know, kind of felt a little caught that I was a little, you know, it's hard to talk about this stuff in a way, because you need to be sensitive. You don't want to, you know, be abusive oneself. But, you know, I'm just talking from my own personal experience. And in the context of, you know, we're coming on Christmas, which is this time, you know, the temporal view of history, this idea that, you know, Jesus' birth and Jesus' death and resurrection and supposed second coming are these, you know, these fundamental, creates a fundamental structure to the cosmos that is, again, alien to the worldview of so many other people and isn't really an imposition. And so I resist the celebration of Christmas personally. I resist that colonial imposition. I would like to be part of a true decolonization movement that actually deconstructs as my monthly co-host Jacqueline Keeler so eloquently talks about, the whole colonial structures that we live within, although we're largely unconscious of them. Well, that's a kind of a long introduction. We're almost halfway through the show. I see I haven't had any callers calling in yet, but the number to call in if you want to talk about Christmas, if you want to talk about, you know, what things that you feel unable to express in the general culture because of, you know, how the culture is so dominated by capitalist ideology and really Christian ideology. And now they're on the resurgence. They're on their high horse with gaining control of the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett and the others now want to roll back, you know, who knows what's going to happen now. Roll back abortion rights. Maybe they want to bring prayer into school again. You know, some of them truly believe this is a Christian nation, although they can't really talk openly about it. So yeah, there really is a culture war going on. And what are we going to do to fight? Well, it looks like we've got two callers real quick here. Let's see who we got on deck. Let's go to our first caller. We have our first caller.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. Who are you?
Hi, this is Camilo.
Hi, Camilo.
Hi. It's really fortuitous. I don't know, maybe spiritually motivated that what you're talking about this morning is something that's been on my mind since about 5 o'clock when I woke up and started reading a chapter in a Buddhist textbook. And I kind of had, I won't call it a revelation, but an insight. And it's about the essentially secular work that we're doing in the climate change, environmentalism, ecology movement. And I really came to realize that my engagement in it really is based on my spirituality, which is Buddhist. And what was so remarkable about that experience of reading this particular chapter was that it totally coincided with what I was reading in Deep Adaptation by Jim Bendel and other authors who are a part of that movement. And he has developed an ideology, and it's really a secular ideology, but to explain how we've arrived at what where we are and how humanity has managed to just stand by and accept and participate the destruction of the planet. And it made me realize that my view of what I do is spiritual, and you know, the spiritual for me is personal. And I think if the environmental movement does not recognize the sacredness of the earth and take the approach that recognizes the nature of the damage that we're doing, it's really not going to accomplish anything. One of the things in Deep Adaptation is that this sort of secular philosophy or ideology that he describes really is very consistent with decolonization thinking. So I think it's really interesting that Deep Adaptation philosophy and decolonization and indigenous belief have really become very closely related to Buddhist philosophy. And for me, there's really no separation of them. And, you know, if the activities and organizations that I participate in really can't embrace that or at least give it respect, I'm going to find another place to express myself and my thoughts and actions and dedication. So what you're saying really is quite in harmony with a kind of deep realization that I experienced last night.
That's I like serendipity or synchronicity. My view that synchronicity is actually a kind of a fundamental part of the fundamental, you can call it structure of the universe. It's a kind of the deep structure of the universe that goes beyond our subjective subjective and objective split. It actually kind of bridges that. Anyway, David Bohm wrote a book called Synchronicity that I really got a lot out of.
That's true, because these concepts really are not able to be understood except through experience. You can learn all of the facts, and that's necessary to guide you on your path, but you have to experience them.
Indeed. Well, you know, I resonate on a spiritual level, on a movement level. These things we're talking about go way, way, way back. One of the things I really liked about Earth First, despite it being, I don't know, this sort of taken on sort of this Nordic mythology or Celtic Nordic mythology, which, you know, somewhat problematic. It'd take too long to really explain all that. But it did try to bring up, it did sort of, and it did open itself to the Native American landscape and Native American lifeways by trying to relate directly to the landscape itself and listening to the land and following the lead of, you know, what the land needs, the Earth First. And also, you know, bringing up sort of the quote pagan sort of ceremonial round, which is more tied to the earth and its seasons. You know, Christmas itself, I know I've talked about this in years past, Christmas itself, it's, I think, widely thought that the reason why December 25th was actually picked for the birth date of Jesus, which was not actually known for certain, was because to basically appropriate the the time of the solstice, because that was still widely practiced, widely participated in terms of ceremonies. But the worldview, the ceremonial religious worldview of the people at the time in Rome and elsewhere, that were celebrating the solstice, and so they kind of brought that in. The whole idea of the Yule log was actually lots of elements of older pagan traditions were brought into the Christmas thing as a way of sort of, you know, selling the Christian religion. Anyway, looks like we got a couple other callers. I'll have to let you go, Camilo. Always nice to hear from you. So yeah, this is a timely topic, as it were. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is Lee. Vindaloria, when I read God is Red, was life-changing for me. I started out reading, things like Black Elk Speaks, but when I hit God is Red, it just changed everything about the way I think, and I really wish that I could have, heard him speak. I pretty much keep his collection of essays, Spirit and Reason, as bedside reading, and whenever I'm bored, I just pretty much pick that up and, spend some time. What I wanted to talk to you about was the last paragraph in God is Red, which I quote on a regular basis, and let me read it. Who will find peace with the lands? The future of mankind lies waiting for those who come to understand their lives and take up their responsibilities to all living things. Who will listen to the trees, the animals, and birds, the voices of the places of the land? As the long-forgotten peoples of the respective continents rise and begin to reclaim their ancient heritage, they will discover the meaning of the lands of their ancestors. That is when the invaders of the North American continent will finally discover that for this land, God is Red.
Yeah, that was written in 1994 at a very, kind of high time for those who were living through it. 1992 had just occurred, the 500th anniversary of the Columbus invasion, and there was all these big celebrations, intercontinental celebrations planned, and then indigenous peoples rose up actually and planned a lot of counter events, counter demonstrations. A lot of really excellent scholarship came out around that time, and I think that was partly some of the inspiration for this. And there's a lot of high hopes. Then the Rio Summit was in 1992, the beginning to talk about on a large scale of the vast impact of humans on our climate and our ecosystems. And, it hasn't really gone all that well since, but it's always, those words always hold a lot of truth and meaning.
Well, I think that God is Red was published in the early 80s. I think it was 1981.
Okay, maybe this is the re-edition of the book.
Right, and but I think in that last paragraph, you mentioned importance of listening, to the land.
It came out in 94. It doesn't say that this is a re-edition. It just says copyright 1994. But anyway, go ahead.
My hard copy, I could dig it out. I think it's 1981. But anyway, listening. We don't listen to the tribal nations peoples. 500 years, and we still don't. Thank you for bringing Jacqueline Keeler in. And thank you, KBOO, for First Voices Radio and things like that. But the most important word in that last paragraph to me is responsibility. We don't take responsibility for our actions vis-a-vis the earth.
Right, because we're structurally and culturally incapable of it.
We don't know what sacred means.
Right. Well, thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
All right. Alienation is the word that comes to my mind. We're this fundamental alienation through this long historical, social, economic, political, cultural process, and how to break free of that. And before I go to my next caller, I felt very privileged and lucky to be able to participate, not just in the ceremonies. I also went to, I participated in Washat ceremonies of the local native religion along the Columbia River, and the Longhouse religion, sweat lodges, and other ceremonies. I could go on, but it was just an amazing thing. But the problem is that we all can't do that. It's just not right. So how, this is a question that plagued me, 30, 40 years ago when I first got into this stuff, was, well, how do we actually bring those, something like that? And this is, a lot of people have struggled with this. How do we try to transform our culture from within somehow? And there's people within all the different traditions, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, others who have taken on that task of, both dialoguing with other religious traditions and also, questioning their own traditions and how their own traditions may embody the same historical alienation process, and how to transform their traditions from within as well. Anyway, we got another caller. Let's go to our next caller. Who might you be?
That must be me.
It is.
Yeah, I'm Norman. First of all, I want to say I don't exactly know how to say what I mean to say, and that is, I live downtown, in a box, in a stack of boxes, and I'm continually struck, well, not continually struck, sometimes struck, by the life that I see in town. You got rats, you got plants growing out of the cracks in the sidewalks, you have mosses on the trees in the North Park blocks and the South Park blocks, and along the river, the bike paths for all of us humongously rich people that have $700 bikes riding recreationally, which, in some moods it seems absurd to me, but I'm a product of the culture I was raised in. The culture of, my parents driving me to school when I was a kid, going on trips to, bleeping Utah to get into nature and stuff. And, I suppose my conflictedness about my relation to the people that have been here time out of mind is I don't feel qualified to participate, not because I'm afraid of appropriation. It's alien to me. Literally alien.
Right. Well, so then
Indians are aliens to me, and I'm alien to Indians.
Well, that's why bringing up the book God is Red. I mean, there's various, there's various roads, there's the road of the intellect, there's the road of the emotion, the road of the body and physical experience. There's various roads. I brought up God is Red because it's, we do read, and it does it does, you know, it does, you can enter into the worldview in that way. It's one way. Like I said, I was lucky. I got kind of a full immersion, you know, and I also kind of put myself out there. You know, you can, anyway, I don't want to tell you, I can't tell you what to do, but sure. I mean, that is a fundamental problem. So that's a starting place. That feeling of alienation itself is a starting place. So how does one find entry points? Well, you know, I think struggle, you know, activism struggle is one good way. I mean, like I said, you know, in Earth First, we just found natural allies with Native Americans because we were defending places that they held dear. And so they were like, oh, okay, other people, you know, maybe it's okay for us to stand up too, you know? Anyway, you know, yeah, it's a problem. It's a big problem. And it's even worse problem for those who are so alienated, they can't even see that they're alienated. And they just carry on blindly this, you know, this horrible process that we're heading down.
Yeah. Everybody's right. Everybody's wrong. Everybody's broken.
Well, like the Buffalo Springfield said, if everybody's right, if anyway, we're starting from a broken place. So how do we repair? How do we do the best to repair? Where do we find entry points back in to wholeness and to healing? You know, some people find it through therapy. Some people are lucky and find it through love relationships. Some people find it, like I said, through activism. But yeah, I mean, don't give up. Find an entry point and take it where you can. You know, the coronavirus isn't making it any easier. But like I said, God is Red is a good start. You know, Vine Deloria is a good starting point. There's lots of others. I've got a whole bunch of books here that I could list, but you know, I think we owe it to ourselves to do that work ourselves, and not just to, you know, not just to whatever. I'm not saying you're wallowing, but find a way. Okay, anyway, thanks for calling. 503-231-8187. So that, you know, you have an opportunity to call in like our three callers this morning have, because this is a live talk radio, and KBOO is one of the only places other than the AM right wingers who are all too omnipresent. You know, you can call into, if you're lucky, you can get on Lars Larson's show. If you're lucky, he's got some heavy screening there. And if you're even luckier, if you start talking about this kind of stuff and you don't get immediately shouted down. I hope I wasn't talking over that last caller. I try to respect people who call in, give them some time and space to talk. You know, it's only an hour, so there's limits. But like I said, this is talk radio. This is KBO Community Radio. I hope you feel like this is your community. This is your community radio station. And this is the time, the end of year membership drive. This is a time for you to express that feeling of connection, that feeling of appreciation for having this vital, precious community resource, whether it's on your terrestrial radio, which I still prefer, or, you know, on your computer or your mobile device, however you listen. If you are on your computer or mobile device, you can right now go to kboo.fm and support us. kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. You know, our regular membership is $60 a year. You can give less. You can give more if you're able. You're certainly not obligated. You know, only 10 or 20%? Of the people who listen actually become members. That's okay. We love to have people listen. Don't get me wrong. Love to have you listen. That's and love to have you call in. Looks like we got a full slate of callers, which I'll get back to in a second, but we do want you to become a member today. and help us meet our goal of $45,000 by December 31st. And, you know, if you give now, you can double the impact of your contribution. During the last week of 2021, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $80,000, courtesy of a group of anonymous KBOO supporters. Together, we can keep KBOO going strong into 2022. Yes, folks, we are going to get through this 2021. You know, we were saying the same thing last year. 2020 seemed eternal. My God, with all the lockdowns, and then it just kept going. And here it is. You know, life seemed to be returning somewhat to normal, and then here we got Omicron. But by God, you got KBOO. KBOO is going to stick with you through thin and thin. And we make a difference in people's lives and in the life of our community and our society. So please, 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 we urge you, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail it in to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Gosh, we've only got 10 minutes and three callers. Let's see how many we can get in. Go ahead. Next, you are on the air.
Deanna.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi. Well, I seldom tune in anymore, but I was really happy to hear this morning's session from you and your real willingness to bare your heart. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
And the other thing is that I didn't call in to give a plug, but I will, because since I arrived here maybe 17 years ago and first heard KBOO, I knew this was the most important community resource this city and the whole area that KBOO reaches has. And I've never been hesitant to give what I could, and that isn't much, but I've given it every month for the past 17 years, and I'm so happy that I have. And I do want to encourage people. I just encouraged about, I think, 50 people through a network that I have this week to listen to KBOO and to support KBOO. So let's hope that that's had some effect.
Thank you, Diane.
And I just, you know, a couple of things, not just a couple of things. I did read God is Red a year or two ago, which is late in my career of knowing about what Vine Deloria has thought and written, and it was very moving to me. And like the most recent caller, I have grappled with how do I engage responsibly, and it is a huge challenge and conundrum, and I just will share the humbly the ways that I have begun, and that is through experience and through reading. But the experience is making myself learn more about everything that's outside me, that surrounds me, that isn't human, let's put it that way, and place, and discovered that right in on the piece of property that the house I live in is located on, there's a whole universe of trees and plants and birds and mycorrhizae and all of these things that through reading such books as Suzanne Simard's book about finding the mother tree, these readings, along with readings by indigenous people, have brought me to a place where I feel closer. And when I walk in the woods, which I do every day, that is my therapy, I really feel a different kind of kinship than I was ever able to feel before, through understanding the community of the trees, the community of the mycorrhizae, the birth and death cycle, and so that, and, you know, just trying to be outside as much as possible, outside of buildings throughout the year. And then when I think about what can I do, I recognize that it is not my place to lead in any way, but to support Native efforts to revitalize their communities, to revitalize their culture, and to bring everything that they can to support Earth and the view of space instead of time. So I give donations to, you know, Lakota Law Project and various other, and, you know, Winona LaDuke's organization and others, as I think, well, that's the way that I can help. So that's what it really what I wanted to say, and I'm so glad about the people who called in and shared what they did. That was really enlightening for me,
Deanna,
in addition to what you said.
I'm so glad you called in. We only have about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
And we do have
say
a couple
goodbye.
Callers. That, just to respect other people, we may be able to get one. I don't know about two. But thanks, Deanna, and everybody else who called. Who's up next?
My name is Molly.
Hi, Molly.
Yeah, hi. Well, first of all, I want to say that as soon as I get off, I'm going to donate. I was going to get that double donation of what I... But I've been madly trying to find on the Internet before that the story. There's a film on the Klickitat River in Lyell where the people saved the land from a landowner that wanted to buy that land with and take away their fishing rights. They're still fishing today there.
Oh, Lyell Point, I think, is what you're talking about, which is actually
Lyell Point.
On the Columbia. Yeah, I was involved, you know, at the beginning of that struggle, way, way back when, yeah.
Right, so you know what I'm talking about, and I've been trying to find it, but what I wanted to say on this today, in this time of these you know, sacred holy times of the solstice, and this quiet of the earth, that the native people have so much to teach, and one of the things that they did teach and succeeded in was by building a sacred fire there at the headwaters where that Klickitat River goes into the Columbia and where their fishing begins. They were able to stave off a land developer who was going to buy that land but could not succeed as long as there was the native sacred ceremony of a fire going on. And they kept that fire, and you may have been there, kept that fire going for, I think, a year. Did not let that fire go out, in which case nobody could develop the land, and they kept their land that way. And I just thought that was such a great, fantastic way to succeed. They, you know, they had the law on their side in this case.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's it was kind of like one in a series of rather improbable victories that were had in that time period, the late 80s and the early 90s, and a lot of losses, a lot of important leaders who were imprisoned and such. But anyway, thank you for bringing that up. That's a wonderful, this, the idea of a sacred fire, what a perfect image for our solstice time. And bringing up the idea of the Yule log and Christmas and all, it just all kind of comes around. I got to let you go because we are almost out of time. I'm going to give one person just a 30 seconds or a minute. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Nathaniel. I'm part of that last generation of anthropologists who were easily able to go abroad and live in different cultures. And I'd just like to say that what we did as anthropologists was a kind of a process. You tried to live as closely as you could with the people you were living with, live like them, without judging or even thinking about it too much, and absorb what it was like to be an X or a Y by being an X or a Y. So it was a learning, living process. The other thing I would say is Blanca Loria's book was first published in 72.
God is Red?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Well, okay, I got all that wrong. Anyway, I wish you had called earlier, Nathaniel. It'd be kind of interesting to actually talk with you. You could maybe leave your contact info if you want with Tammy, if she wants, after I sign off, which is in a couple seconds. Or you can get in touch with me through Facebook. Anybody else can. I have a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can like that. You can get in contact with me. Anyway, thank you, Nathaniel. That was really interesting. I would have liked to talk to you more, but we are flush out of time. We are end of year drive. Please support KBOO. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Give what you can. We appreciate it. That's how we keep going. Thanks, Tammy, for running the board today. All right. See you, everybody.
proclaim the glories. Deaf man listened closely as he danced, seeing into pictures blind man painted. Mother Goose and Brothers Grimm laughed knowingly up their sleeves. The grown-ups are the children's children, captured and taught what to believe, sampling fables and other realities.
Fables.
Prototype people. Rigid suit trolls near brain dead. Under for spacious skies gathering storm clouds. Rule of law, a falling axe in stormtroopers' hands. Cruel class deceivers claim God for their side. Making up stories with places for meanings to hide. Dracula drinks deeply while nourishing his trap. The love of man.
To listener-supported community radio, KBOO.
Tune in to KBOO at 5 p.m. on December 22nd and 23rd to hear the premiere episodes of the KBOO podcast, Row on the Rocks. The show investigates what a post-Roe versus Wade Oregon will look like, where many Oregonians already have limited access to abortion health care, even though they live in a state with some of the most progressive abortion laws in the country. What happens when neighboring states like Idaho enact their trigger laws to immediately outlaw abortion care? Experts expect an influx of patients who will travel hundreds or even thousands of miles to Oregon just to receive access to abortion services. Row on the Rocks is executive produced by KBOO's Claire Rosciato. Hear the premiere episodes on KBOO at 5 p.m. on December 22nd and 23rd, or anytime online at KBOO.fm.